non-zero mass particles to 99.9999999% the speed of light. You can also get Kelvin down to, you know, 0.00000001 Kelvin. But you just can't get to zero, and you can't get to the speed of light if you have a non-zero rest mass.
George's original question, do any of these velocities change as a function of temperature? And I think the answer is partially yes. Let me drop. That fancy material they use for fancy oscillators called barium tetratitinate. One particular version of it has a dielectric constant of 100. Square root of 100 means that the material, that the radio beam or the light beam spreads through it at 1/10 the speed of light in a vacuum. However, barium tetratitinate, like every other material, has a curve of dielectric constant versus temperature. When you go down toward near 0 degrees Kelvin, I don't know the exact number, but maybe the dielectric constant used to be 100, became 110. So therefore, you could get a slight speed up or a slight slowdown of a radio beam traveling through that material as you approach 0 degrees Kelvin. I don't think that's violating any of our things that you've talked about up till now, Roy. AC2GS, K2LAW.
No, if you're talking about temperature changing the apparent velocity of light in a medium, no, it's perfectly fine and acceptable, and the theory of relativity doesn't say one thing or the other about it. It's just that it's more of a semantic kind of psychological thing, that it's not actually the photon being slowed down, but more of a phase interaction, as I mentioned before. But the apparent velocity can decrease. Ultimately, you know, photons most of the time are traveling in the vacuum of space. They're indifferent to temperature. Average kinetic energy of empty space isn't that much of anything. So I think it's probably unwise to get focused too much on temperature changes caused changes with relativity, personally.
Got a crazy question for you, Roy. Stand by.
H2FIU.
On that, George recognized. On that previous question where I talked about I'm climbing into a spaceship from the Earth, I'm traveling toward the moon at a pretty high velocity. You're standing on the moon, you're aiming a laser beam at me, and I'm measuring the speed, and I measure the speed of light that the light is coming toward me, even though I'm moving relative to the Earth and the moon. If there really was an ether material filling up the space between Earth and Moon, and I repeated that experiment, if there really was an ether material, would I get a different answer? AC2GS, K2LAW, then turn it over to George.
It would be a much more different world, but I would say that yes, you would. And this is why even Lorentz was looking for a luminiferous ether. These guys really took this seriously. They took it as seriously as we take dark energy and dark matter today. And it was not a question of whether it was. It was the first guy who proves it and explains it wins a Nobel Prize. So if it actually did exist, you would notice a difference. And they worked with interferometers until the cows came home trying to prove this concept, unfortunately.
Thank you, Dick. You asked the question in different words that I was just going to ask. Because as we approach absolute zero, and all matter is going to have an effect in any relative speed that it has.
Well, not really in the vacuum of space. There's nothing much in the way of matter.
Where is there a vacuum if there is matter out there? If there are light-producing bodies out there, it's not a true vacuum.
When Story Musgrove, during the repair of the Hubble Space Telescope, a very significant mission that he had, let me drop it. One of the first questions he asked himself is, what temperature will I be subjected to while I'm doing the spacewalk? It's sort of saying, what is the temperature of space? And it doesn't have a temperature because space itself, particularly the space that he was in, 240 miles above the Earth, is so close to a hard vacuum that the temperature he experienced is strictly a function of whether or not the sun was shining on him. When he was in sunlight, he was nice and warm. During the time the Earth, you know, 16, 18 times in the orbit per day, the Hubble Space Telescope and the Space Shuttle were both on the backside of the Earth as far as the sun is concerned. He was exposed to darkness, and he was extremely cold. All the fingers on his glove were not very well insulated. To this day, he no longer has any feeling in the tips of the fingers of his glove because his fingers essentially got frozen during that repair mission. So what is the temperature of space is strictly a function of what sun is shining on you at the time you make the measurement and what's the color of the material that's on your body at that time. The color of the reflective material on his gloves was not absorbing enough sunlight, and there's no way he could store that during the half hour that he was in the darkness. Over to you, Roy, KQRAW.
Yes, quite right. I mean, the problem is that in a way, certainly George is correct as well. There's something in space. Space is not empty. There are quantum fluctuations in space. There are fields in space, if you believe quantum field theory, that define all the particles and all the energy states in the grand unified theory. So there's something in the very substance of space. We can go into that as well. But it doesn't have a temperature. It doesn't have an average kinetic energy. It has a very, very, very small particle count, both virtual particles and real particles. And there's even less real particles as you go further into the spaces between galactic clusters and such. So it doesn't really have a temperature, George. I'm sorry.
If one of the definitions of temperature is the average kinetic energy of the molecules that are in the container where you're putting your thermometer, and if that container contains no molecules, if it's an extremely hard vacuum like you get in space, if there are no molecules there, therefore there is no kinetic energy of the non-molecules there, therefore there's no reasonable definition of temperature. If the sun is shining on you, and if somebody's aiming a laser beam at you, or somebody's aiming a radio beam at you, you can sense a certain kind of temperature depending on your absorption of the materials. But space itself doesn't really have a temperature, does it, Roy?
Is it to be clear?
Doesn't. I mean, there will be, if you take an object, if you stick a thermometer or any kind of a thermal probe anyplace and put it in the deepest part of space, it won't reach, obviously, zero Kelvin, because, as I said before, that's impossible. There will be a degree of radiation that will be absorbed that will cause it to be in equilibrium for a very, very, very low non-zero temperature. So that's about the closest you could get as the, quote, temperature of space. But it's very dependent upon where you put that probe in relation to light sources and energy sources that can go into equilibrium with the object.
AC2PL, K2IW. Go ahead, I think your name is Jeffrey. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Good evening, Dick. Interesting conversation. And just from I've taken physical chemistry, but just from kind of a layman's standpoint and considering average kinetic energy, how is it that someone's glove can become lower in average kinetic energy when there's nothing to have a collision with? Go ahead, Dick.
This is close to a measurement that I made, Jeff. When I set up that 12-foot diameter dish that you can see in the August issue 1972 QST magazine, you see it on the front cover, and the article's inside of how I built this dish to listen to the Apollo astronauts, among other things I did with it. And I had a very good low-noise parametric amplifier at 2 gigs connected to that feed horn. And I'm aiming the dish up at a 45-degree angle into clear blue sky. And connected to it was a very sensitive receiver, a so-called radiometer. It's a radio telescope-like receiver. I wanted to readjust the feed horn to position. I wanted to better focus the feed horn in front of this parabolic dish. I stood up on a wooden chair, and I put myself in the middle, in the front of this 12-foot dish, put my hands up on the feed horn, and somebody looking at the receiver said, whatever you just did, peg the receiver, peg the signal strength meter. It turns out that my body, radiating 2 gig signal, because its receiver was tuned to 2.2875 megahertz, that's the frequency of the command service module. Let me drop the RF energy coming off my body, being picked up by this dish, and the dish is aimed at cold sky, 3-degree beamwidth, aimed at blue sky, up at a 45-degree angle in elevation, and I'm standing on a wooden chair in front of it, and the radiation coming off my body pegged the signal strength meter on that very sensitive receiver. I am radiating signals at all kinds of frequencies, infrared, radio, and whatever, because I am cold, I am hotter than the background radiation. I'm a radiator. Anything above absolute zero, I think it's the Rayleigh law, but anyhow, Roy's going to tell us the name of the law, the guy who wrote the law. You can tell exactly how much energy is coming off of something because it's warm. Okay, that glove on Story Musgrove, in a cold environment, is radiating energy off of his glove. Because he was in the darkness behind the earth, so to speak, on the backside of the earth, and he was not even in front of the space shuttle. He was all of the radiation coming off his glove, which ordinarily would hit something else that's warm and radiate back, was going into space and leaving. If you waited long enough, if you did an experiment by putting a test tube of water inside the finger of that glove and hanging it out in space where he was, and you got a thermometer in that test tube, I am guessing that temperature would go down to something like minus 200 degrees centigrade, if you know what I mean, because the heat radiated by the glove is going out into space and never coming back. Everything radiates. In your living room, the radiation from your finger, from your body, is being equaled by the radiation of the wall giving energy back to your body and the temperature of the air around you. In free space, you didn't have all of that. Does that help a little bit, Jeff? Over to you, K2RAW.
K2RIW AC2PL. Yeah, now of course I've recollected some of what I've forgotten. And it makes sense. Of course, we go around with these little FLIR, what are they, FLIR infrared cameras and look at things, and that's because of the radiation coming off. And of course, the zero point energy that you guys were talking about, we used to talk about in just the bond vibrational energy, and of course that's coming off at an IR. But there's so many other ways to think about the way molecules behave that it makes sense that we're radiating and we're capacitors and we're all kind of we're a multi-lumped term electronic device in ourselves. Go ahead, Dick. Thanks very much.
WS2N.
Are you? Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, I'm thinking about all the. On the International Space Station, well, a lot of the space satellites have it, but you know, especially the space station has these massive radiators that you see. They're very dark looking, extending from the truss sections. They're all designed to get rid of the heat from the solar panels that are picking up the solar radiation. International Space Station itself, all those modules, they have to get rid of the heat. And the only way they could do it is to actually radiate it, you know, not with convection or anything, but putting it through those big radiators. And those radiators are really nothing like, they're just like the big gloves on Story Musgrave's hand. They're just radiating the heat away. Back to you, Dick.
Got a quick question for you, Paul. Wait for the beeps. what's the total electrical power coming out of those solar panels on the International Space Station? How many kilowatts are they producing, roughly?
If they're all running 128 kilowatts, so it's quite a bit. Let's see. I think it was 6, 12, 18, 24. Yeah, I think roughly, yeah, that's probably about it. You can run, they say, 40 homes on the equivalent power that's coming in on a 24-hour basis. And each home would be 4,000 K. So, there you go. Back to Dick.
If it's 100 kilowatts being produced and it'll run 40 homes, that means each home is using, on average, 2.5 kilowatts, which is about right. Okay, let's assume that the solar panels are making 100 kilowatts. That's how much real electrical power is coming out of them. Some of it's lost in the converters that give you 110 volts AC out of the DC and so on. So all of your instruments, your oscilloscopes and your exercising machines and your oxygen generators and your water purifiers and everything else and the blowers and all that jazz inside of the International Space Station is absorbing something close to 100 kilowatts of electrical energy. None of that is turning wheels that are in contact with the ground, like your automobile. Let me drop. It's not pushing the orbit. It's not turning the spacecraft. It's not doing anything as far as the outside world is concerned. All of that is electrical energy poured into that internal space where the astronauts are located. There is nothing left over after it's done its thing but heat. Therefore, except for the heat being radiated by the walls of the International Space Station, which is probably only a few kilowatts worth, close to 100 kilowatts of heat is being injected into that space with the astronauts. Therefore, those external radiators have to be radiating close to 100 kilowatts, otherwise the temperature inside would continuously be climbing. Do you see it that way, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, exactly. And you'll see four sets of solar panels. Each set has its own radiator, and those are all turning with the solar panels. They turn, you know, roughly once every 90 minutes as they go around the Earth. So they're constantly, you know, heating up, and then they get to the dark side, and then the radiators take over their job and radiate the heat. And if you look at them, they're faced 90 degrees apart from the solar panels. The solar panels, they're trying to keep always facing toward the sun. The radiators are the other way around. They're trying to keep the edge on part of that toward the sun. But yeah, you got a lot of power before it even gets into the space station that has to be radiated out. And then the 10 pieces, each living quarters, roughly like a 10-room house, has to be radiated, and they have their own radiators that come off in the middle of the space station. You can see them. There's four on each side, four on a port and four on a starboard side. Back to you, Dick. Question.
Everything that's above absolute zero radiates some amount of temperature, the so-called black body temperature. What's the name of the Guy's Law that gives you that curve of radiation versus wavelength once you know the physical temperature of the object? What's that guy's name, Roy? And then turn it over to the guy with the question. You've got it, Roy.
I wish I knew the history. I know about black body radiation, and the concept is relatively simple, that anything other than 0 degrees Kelvin will emit some degree of electromagnetic energy, and that everything is in equilibrium with each other, so it balances out the amount of kinetic energy through radiation. As you talk to the next guy, I will feverishly look up the name of the guy who drew up the curve.
NY2H, is that Planck?
Might be Planck, it might be Riley, Eugene, one of those guys. The person who asked question, now go right ahead, question.
NY2HY. When the space station goes around and it's in the shadow of the Earth, with reference to the sun, what gives you the power? Are you running on batteries all the time in the space station, and the solar cells supplement the battery power, or are they running totally on solar cells? What happens?
I'll bet you it's batteries. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, since it's been up there, they run these nickel hydrogen batteries, they're called, and they're in the process of all being replaced. They're massive. You know, you have many thousands of pounds of batteries on each section. On the PS truss section, you know, you'll have a complete solar panel section, and that will have batteries, also one radiator. And then you come in, you got another section with the massive solar panels, you know, each set of solar panels, 240 feet long by 40 feet wide. And again, that'll have its own solar panel, as well as its own batteries. And they're in the presence of replacing these nickel hydrogen batteries with lithium polymer batteries there. They're bringing them up slowly but surely. They bought the first group up, I think, last year. There's about three more groups to follow. And many spacewalks are involved in changing these things out. They're doing some of the stuff without... you know, EVAs, but, you know, a lot of it still has to be done with the EVAs. You see that you'll see that over the next couple of years as they replace these things. Back to you, Dick.
I've got a guess here, Roy. I mean, Paul. During the time the sunlight is shining on those solar panels, you're getting something close to 100 kilowatts capability. During the time the International Space Station is on the dark side of the Earth, away from the sun, and the solar panels are aimed at the Earth, all of those lights of human beings down there on the planet are giving a little bit of illumination up to the space station. Instead of 100 kilowatts, I'll bet you're getting something like 1 watt of energy out of the solar panels, which is such a low voltage you can't use it.
Repeater, timeout.
That's a guess on my part, Paul. Have they ever mentioned whether or not they get any power out of the solar panels when they're on the dark side of the Earth? WS2N, K2RIW.
No, they never mentioned that, but I wouldn't think it would have much to light up a 100-watt light bulb. But, by the way, it's roughly about 160 kilowatts total. Averages around 120. A lot of times they'll have a problem with the whole thing, and they'll shut down one third. So they still have plenty of power to run when they have like two thirds up and running. They've done that for months at a time. That's why when the space shuttle used to be coming up, they'd like jumper wires. You know, they're not real jumper wires, but they would plug into the space station, and the shuttle would be able to stay up for an extra, like, 3 or 4 more days than not visiting the space station. So they got so much power, they don't know what to do with it. So, yeah, they turn the solar rays on the starboard and on the port side. Let me drop it. They use this big joint. They call it the Alpha. The solar Alpha rotary joint. It's about as big as a Volkswagen. A big turning thing, and that will turn the whole couple of segments on each side, and then there's one just like it on the opposite side, and that's the Alpha joint. So then that turns it one way to constantly face the sun, and then you'll need to turn the panels themselves, so they have Beta joints, each set of panels going out. 240-foot long panels, on 120 feet of it gets turned by another electrical motor. And they're called the beta joints. So you got the alpha and the beta systems. And they've been working all these years, wow, since they've bought these things up. Back to you, Dick.
Another question.
It sounds like you've got gimbals that you can really turn them in two separate directions. In other words, if I represent with reference to the center of the Earth, I can take those solar panels, I can sweep them in azimuth with the alpha joint, and I can sweep them in elevation with the beta joint. Is that roughly what's going on here, Paul? Go ahead.
Exactly. And you can't really find a video that, you know, points to this. The only way you could see these things actually functioning is, like, you bring up a video for looking at the northern lights, you know, and they'll show the northern lights, but they won't show it in slow motion, you know. Instead of this thing going 17,000 miles an hour, you know, they've got, you know, going about 10 times that speed, so they're really whizzing around the Earth. So you're looking at the horizon, you're looking at the northern lights, but look at the space station's solar panels when you look at those videos, and you'll see these things turning. It's really amazing. I mean, they're just whizzing around. Actually, they're going very slow. You know, like I said, it takes about an hour and a half for them to make a complete revolution. But that's one way to see that these things are not only turning in the alpha direction, but like you said, they're in the beta direction as well.
Go ahead with your next question, George.
Joe.
Sorry, but it's Paul. What have you found? It's fascinating. There was one question I had hoped to get answered tonight, and it has to do again with approaching the speed of light. And I remember that there was some positing years back about as you approach the speed of light, your mass would grow. And if you hit the speed of light, you'd have infinite mass. Is that true?
I don't know if that was to me. I think we got confused with Joe. But the mass question, yes, as far as I know, that's true. But, Dick, I think we're doing two questions at one time. Back to you, Dick.
You might want to take that one, Roy.
Okay. Theoretically, well, let me throw my call sign, AC2GS. Theoretically, if you could travel at the speed of light, you would have an infinite amount of what's called inertial mass. The problem is, in order to do that, you would theoretically also need an infinite amount of energy to get you there. An infinite amount of energy is a lot of energy. It's more than the energy of this universe or 1,000 other universes. So somewhere, if you had a source of infinite energy, I guess theoretically, sort of, maybe kind of, you would have infinite inertial mass. But since you can't find any, you can't get there from here.
Let me boil that down to a real situation. Stand by. With the Large Hadron Collider, it takes a certain amount of energy to accelerate the particles in that vacuum tunnel up to the 99% of the speed of light. A certain amount of energy is required for it. Let's call it one unit. I don't know the exact number, but I'm guessing it takes one more unit of energy to go from 99% to 99.9%. And it's going to take one more unit of energy to go from 99.9 to 99.99. Are the numbers moving exponentially, sort of like that, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW.
In a word, yes. What you end up, if anyone's taken math, is you reach an asymptotic a limit where it just goes straight up. If you ever take a look at a tangent curve, that thing just keeps on going up. It never stops. So it's sort of the same thing when it gets to trying to get something at the height. You just run out of energy eventually. It just there's no up there. There's no limit up there. It's just all the way up and beyond.
Now, two more things are going on with that Large Hadron Collider. Let me drop. When you accelerate those particles to 99% of the speed of light, you put in a certain amount of energy. You go from 99% to 99.9, Maybe it's one more unit of energy. You've only moved by 1%. It's the same amount of energy as to go from 0 to 99%, so to speak. And if you take that beam that you've accelerated to 99.9, the material has extra mass, call it extra kinetic energy. If you dump that beam into a common pile, you'll get all of that energy back that you've put into it. Second of all, another way you know that the extra mass is there is that in order to keep the beam into a circular path to keep it in the tunnel, you need to increase the strength of the magnetic field that's bending the beam. So as you add energy and the apparent mass goes up, you need more magnetic energy, and you better have more capability of your dummy load if you have to dump that beam, because you're going to get all that energy back again. AC2GS, K2IW.
Yeah, but it even gets spookier, because since you're going close to relativistic speeds, the half of particles gets very confusing if you don't allow for that, because all of a sudden things that really shouldn't last very long seem to last longer because they're experiencing time dilation as well as inertial mass equivalency and other, you know, esoteric concepts of relativity. So it's, to me, it's just as spooky as anything in quantum mechanics. I find it hard to believe that Einstein had so much problems with quantum mechanics, but fully accepted his own theory as obvious.
If when you collide that beam with something and you generate some crazy particles that have a certain life, are you saying in that last transmission that the life of those particles gets extended because of the higher relativistic velocity you had before you did that collision? Go ahead.
Well, it ultimately depends upon the velocity of the particles that you both injected into the system and created. You have to correct for their relativistic speed in order to make sense of how long they exist in time. If they're going close to the speed of light, they're not going to have the same half-life as if it was sitting there in zero velocity. So these guys know this off the top of their head, so they correct it all the time. But to us, the fact that time goes at a different rate for subatomic particles being sped up in a accelerator strikes us as not terribly intuitive.
Hey, George, what's your next question? You're on a roll.
Are you speaking to me, Rich, NY98?
Okay, I'll take either, George. N198, you got it.
All I can do is give you my thanks. I have really appreciated this, and I'm glad to have had an authoritative answer. I have 65 other questions about time travel and all the rest of it, but holy mackerel, guys. My head is busting from this, and I've got a son who is a master's degree in physics, and he explained it to me the other day, and now I've had you fellas, and I think it was a marvelous thing that you did tonight. Thank you so much. And I do hope we'll do this more. This is a big subject. K2RIW, NY98.
It's probably as big as the universe. And this material is so darn strange, you've got to hear it multiple times from multiple instructors before it starts making sense. How in the world did you acquire all of this, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW. I think you're a great big book reader.
Yes, I mean, I'll do everything. I read those articles in Scientific American on the subject. I have books. I have a book from a PhD guy who spent 300 pages on a review article of whether or not charged particles in a gravitational field will emit an electromagnetic radiation. He spent 300 pages on a review article, and at the end he basically says maybe, maybe not, who knows. So, I don't know, all this stuff fascinates me. I read the popular stuff, I read the not-so-popular stuff, I read the easy graduate-level stuff, because the more difficult graduate-level stuff just gives me a headache. You were mentioning Krauss's book. Krauss's book almost gave me a nosebleed. Way too many equations, not enough adjectives, adverbs, and nouns.
AC2PL query.
PL recognized. Stand by a second. Yes, that's what I was saying earlier. Somebody heard me say that Krauss's book called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950, And he was going to go out and get a, he thought it was an article, he's going to get a copy of it. I'm giving him warning ahead of time that that's a graduate level book written in the days of 1950 in which we were not as smart about knowing that man is a visual animal, and you got to give him a lot of graphs and pictures of concepts. The loftiest words you use on certain people are going to strike them, they're going to hit them flat, if you know what I mean. It's not going to draw a mental image. You got to supply. Modern day textbooks are a hell of a lot heavier in computer generated three-dimensional graphics to convey concepts a hell of a lot better. The new person, go ahead, give us your full call and your name. I'm KQRIW, and you're also hearing AC2GS, Roy, and I'm Dick. Go ahead, new person.
Here's Alpha Charlie 2 Papa Lima. Is that me you're referring to?
Papa Lima, I am. So give us your, wait for the beeps, and give us your full, your name, sir.
Sorry, Dick, it's Jeff Alpha Charlie 2 Papa Lima once again, and I agree with what George said, NY9A. It's been very informative in helping me to relearn some of what I've forgotten. But the question is, and I think it's just a matter of how you frame the answer to help people understand. It's the same question as before: is any radiation generated during a fission reaction? And I think the answer must be no. If an infinite amount of energy is required to accelerate something to speed of light, but perhaps you can explain it to us in a different sense.
Boy, I'll bet you fission, fusion, all of those reactions give off all kinds of rays, all kinds of energy. Is that true, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
It has one of those great answers. It depends. It depends on what you're fusing and what you're fissioning. If you're fusing together anything above iron, it's an exothermic reaction. If you're fissioning anything heavier than iron, it's an exothermic reaction. Otherwise, it's endothermic. A fission for things like hydrogen on down to right below iron will all produce a net energy, which will produce radioactive products. So it's not a zero output. If that were the case, the sun would immediately go out, and we would freeze to death. So for a good thing, a fusion works, and fission just as well. If fission didn't produce a lot of radioactive products, then you wouldn't have the chain reaction, and nuclear bombs wouldn't work, which in some cases might be a good thing.
So, one of the raw materials used for fissioning, to run a fission reactor, is uranium, 235, 238, which one of those, which is way above the atomic number of iron. Therefore, when that fission takes place, it's giving off a hell of a lot of energy. When fusion takes place and you're starting off with the hydrogen and making helium molecules, you have to supply an awful lot of energy to get over the hill to start getting the fusion reaction to giving you energy back. And to my knowledge, all of mankind's attempts to make a fusion reactor on Earth have not turned a positive result yet. Is that roughly true, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
Sort of a matter of semantics, because ultimately, I guess you could define a hydrogen bomb as a fusion-based reactor. It's not a very friendly one. It doesn't last very long, and you can't really control it much. But mankind, in its infinite wisdom, has learned how to at least initiate a fusion reaction.
So, I think you're saying that every hydrogen bomb has a uranium fission bomb to set it off. So the fission bomb creates the pressure and temperature to take the hydrogen fusible material and create the fusion that then gives you the hydrogen bomb. So it's really at least a two-stage bomb. And so as a pulse of a few microseconds, we can get a fusion reaction. But a continuous fusion reaction to run a power station Every time we look at how they're doing, they're always 20 years away from having a good working unit. And they've been doing that now for many, many multiples of 20, as I remember. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
AC2GS. Yes, they've been doing that too with artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence that would be self-sentient is always 20 years away, no matter what year you talk to these guys about it. So these are things that just keep on getting pushed out into the horizon. But yeah, as far as a fusion bomb, the fission material is just the detonator in their mind. It leads to a lot of fusion reaction. They dope it with tritium and such to make it easier to sustain a reaction. It has probably a lot more tritium in it than the sun requires, but the sun has gravitational forces of incredible pressure and heat, so they get it a different way. But we can kind of mimic the sun for a fraction of a second and blow a good piece of whatever out of existence. You know, so much for mankind.
From everything you read, Roy, do you see a logical future for a fusion reaction power station in your lifetime? Would you bet 50% probability that you're going to see one in your lifetime, Roy? Go ahead.
It's always problematic to try and predict discoveries, because discoveries just kind of pop up out of nowhere. And, you know, if you ever go through old copies of popular science about what the future would bring, you would get an idea for how incredibly wrong everyone is about predicting stuff. So, you know, some guy in some garage someplace could have invented something next Wednesday and revolutionized the entire field. I tend not to think so. I think it's going to happen probably after we're all gone, but I don't think that should slow us down in at least trying to find the answer. And along the way, I'm sure we'll find the answer to other things that we didn't even think we wanted the answers to.
PD2HUC with a question.
HUC, go ahead.
Well, right now, you know, mankind has a means to, I guess you could call it, control a fission reaction using boron rods. Does any such technology exist for being able to throttle, so to speak, a fusion reaction? KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. So what moderators do we have that have worked very well, Roy? And obviously the one they used in Chernobyl wasn't the right one, so to speak, or they misused it.
Well, the problem is that fission reactors do well with chain reactions, and that's why they're used. What happens with uranium is that it'll give off two neutrons. If you slow the neutrons down, they're called thermal neutrons. If they're too fast, they just whiz by everything. If you slow them down with a carbon pile, they will get into the other uranium atoms and cause a chain reaction of each of those producing two neutrons. So you get two neutrons, they give you four neutrons, they give you eight neutrons, they give you 16 neutrons, and before you know it, everything's going boom. Now you put the mediators in to slow down and speed up the neutrons and absorb the neutrons, and you can pretty much control the chain reaction. There's no real great chain reaction mechanism for fusion. You just have to get the pressure and the temperatures, and it kind of takes off on its own. So it lacks the elegance, in a way, of a controlled chain reaction method.
Let's go back to fission for a second. If the carbon rods slow down the neutrons so that they can be used in the chain reaction, that makes it sound like if the carbon rods weren't there, the neutrons would move so fast and you wouldn't have a chain reaction. That seems opposite of what I know, where I think you have to slam the carbon rod in to stop the reaction, so to speak. The first statement would make it sound like if you yanked out the carbon rods, all of them immediately, that you'd have no reaction. I don't think that's the way it works, but fill me in on that one, Roy, K2LIW.
Well, my understanding of the way these things are built is that they're kind of built in with a certain level of neutron absorber and slowers. So even if you pulled all the rods, what you'd end up with is not slowing down, speeding up the neutrons, because there's still enough material in the pile that slows down the neutrons. The control piles are pretty much to absorb the neutrons and kind of squelch the thing. Because there's no good purpose for building one that gives you a fast neutron that zooms past everything. So they kind of design in the neutron slowing elements, and the control elements are more purely for absorption.
If I've got a super fast neutron that's come out of the first step of a reaction, and that super fast neutron hits dead zero, the nucleus of the next uranium atom, you're saying it would have no effect? Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, if you located it together in a critical mass, again, you're stuck with an atomic bomb. So the idea is to spread it out, and that's when you have to deal with slow, with thermal neutrons versus the high-speed neutrons. So it's a different thing. You don't really require any kind of neutron slowing in a nuclear bomb, because you put it into a critical mass and it kind of goes off on its own. It's the nuances of having a controlled chain reaction going on that requires the finessing and spreading things out below its critical amount density.
So with less than critical mass, the neutrons must be slowed down in order to continue the chain reaction. Whereas if I'm above a critical mass, I don't have to worry about the velocity anymore. I'm going to get a bang, is what I think you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, at the point of spreading it out to a non-critical mass, you're more interested in the efficiency. You might still get something out of it, but if you slow it down, you'll get a bigger, more efficient power out of the system. So, bombs are built a little bit different even than generators, thankfully.
These nuclear people quite often talk about equivalent cross-sectional area. When I have a less than critical mass of uranium and I'm running a nuclear fission reactor and I'm slowing down these neutrons, does the slower neutron think that the equivalent cross-section of the next nucleus I want to hit, does a slower neutron think that that cross-section has increased? Is that sort of what's happening, Roy? K2LIW?
Well, I don't think you could describe it quite like that, because if it did happen quite like that, then you're still stuck with something that would go off with a chain reaction. The idea is you want to have a chain reaction controllable and slow enough. And so in critical mass, if you trick the object into thinking it's at a critical mass, you've kind of given the keys away from the car, and they'll just take off and blow up. So, again, this is a kind of very, very delayed, controlled, high-efficiency production of thermal energy that you then run water into steam and run turbos on it.
Derek Mueller, who has a whole series of YouTube videos that are very effective, Veritasium, he calls them, he's got quite a few of them all labeled a twist the tail of the dragon slowly. So when it comes to a nuclear fission reactor, I think you're walking a very narrow fence between having enough mass to get a good reaction and yet not going over the threshold where you become a critical mass. Is that part of what he's referring to when he talks about twisting the tail of the dragon very slowly? Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Yeah, I think for the most part, there isn't an incredibly high risk of a full-blown nuclear bomb. What usually happens is you'll have thermal runaway, and everything will just melt and spray radioactive material all over the local area. You know, there'll be some explosions. It's a real messy thing when those things go bad. So, it doesn't just turn completely into an atomic bomb. It kind of messes around with all kinds of permutations of different ways of going terrible. You got to be very cautious, and that's why people were thinking seriously about thorium-based reactors, which tend to, theoretically at least, be relatively safer if they could prove the concept for a full-size generator, which for some reason no one really was interested in doing.
Roy, do you have a way of explaining what went wrong in Chernobyl? Why did they get that kind of a runaway? Go ahead.
Usually these things have a problem with the coolant section, and they simply don't supply enough coolant to the heating element, and it goes into a thermal runaway, and then you have a problem of getting it under control. And in Chernobyl, they had no way of getting anything under control. The control aspects of that plant were awful. So, you know, when things started to get pear-shaped, rather than a controlled shutdown, which is what happened in other places, it just kind of overheated, melted, and blew. It was a mess. But I think it was ultimately a failure in the coolant system.
Yeah, the condition was also being aggravated by the fact that they were running some kind of a test, and they were turning off some of the safety systems in order to proceed with the test. And so they did a dangerous test, and they started deviating from the recipe, so to speak, and got themselves into an awful lot of trouble. And so that chunk of land is still uninhabitable, and I think it's going to be for another 100 years or so.
There are still people who immigrated from that area who are getting discovered to have thyroid cancers and all kinds of other malignancies. So the gift just keeps on giving, unfortunately.
What's sad is that in the beginning, the people who were studying reliability of fission reactors worldwide used to say that, we're going to get an accident, but once per million years. Well, we've used up that million years 3 or 4 times in a row now, T2RIW. Obviously, the people doing the estimating didn't realize some of the stupid mistakes that can be made, and maybe overall they were so optimistic. They didn't understand enough of the details of how you can get into trouble, T2RIW.
What can I say? Science suffers from hubris sometimes, and you know how hubris gets, what you get from hubris. So we got, you have to expect the worst and make cases to design against that type of thing. And inevitably there will be people out there who want to cut corners and cut the cost of things and not really be worried about the future if the present takes care of itself. So you got to factor human nature into any kind of scientific equation. Scientists sometimes leave out the human beings.
The main thrust of Roy's talk tonight is on special and general relativity. You guys out there listening, have any further questions before we go over to the next session of the TechNet, which will be the space report? So do you have any final questions for Roy on the subject of, let's say, special and general relativity? Give us your call letters right now, K2RIW.
Hey, CTPL.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Thanks, Dick. Sorry, I didn't let it drop. I wanted to rephrase the question I gave before. So during a fission reaction, or a fusion reaction indeed, this may be a naive or a complex question, I'm not really sure. Is anything that's not traveling at the speed of light converted into something that is traveling at the speed of light? And it seems theoretically impossible, so there must be some other interaction or conversion going on. Sorry for the perhaps strange question. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, let's see what Roy got out of that. You got it, Roy.
Well, the way that you phrased it, the answer is yes, it does, because part of the resultant in fusion is the release of gamma rays. Gamma rays are electromagnetic. Electromagnetic waves have a rest mass of zero and a velocity of the speed of light.
When particles, when nuclear reaction, when nuclear radiation is taking place, and let's say, for instance, a chunk of uranium is sitting on my desk, and my Geiger counter sitting alongside is measuring those particles coming out of there. I'm hearing clicks. What's the approximate velocity of those particles coming out of there, Roy? K2LAW?
Okay, you got to kind of differentiate between the neutrons and the gamma rays, because once again, the gamma rays are always going at the speed of light. Neutrons, it depends. They go fast. They go probably something along the range of half the speed of light, a quarter of the speed of light. Fast, but not at close to relativistic velocity.
Is there any simple way you can determine what is causing a particular velocity of those neutrons coming out of that natural fissioning material? What sets their speed? If I have high purity and low purity uranium, 235 or 238, do I get a different velocity of the neutrons? Over to you, Roy.
It's ultimately conservation of mass energy, conservation of momentum, all those symmetries that lead to conservation you have to make allowances for. So particles that are released have a certain mass energy. If you have extra energy from the reaction, you have to have it all equal out. So the only place that you could do is either have a gamma ray emission, which is a way of balancing the energy equation, or by increasing the velocity. So if you have a much more energetic reaction, but you don't create any more particles, the particles that you create have to have higher momentum, which amounts to a faster velocity.
If I've got a chunk of uranium sitting on the table, and I'm a little bit too close to it, and therefore I'm suffering some damage, I've got alpha particles called neutrons coming out of there. I've got beta particles called electrons maybe coming out of there. I've got gamma rays coming out of there. Which of those three kinds of things coming out of there, and to what degree are they injurious to me if I'm getting that near-field exposure? Over to you, Roy, K2LAW. And by the way, those alpha particles, how far do they penetrate into my body?
They barely penetrate. Back in the bad old days, they had these things, radium watches. They would paint little radium on the hands of the dial, and it would glow in the dark. And so they gave a bunch of poor women the job of painting those hands, and they would wet the brush on their tongue. So they would dip it into the radium dye, lick their tongue, and paint. And a lot of them came down with head and neck cancers because of it. But you got to get the alpha particles inside you to do anything bad. Beta particles are very fast electrons. Again, within a fraction of a millimeter, they get absorbed because they're charged and they're not that massive. Where you get into trouble are the gamma rays. Gamma rays are sort of like X-rays. They're ionizing radiation. They can run right through you, and they can disrupt every molecule that they come anywhere near. They particularly like to chew on your DNA, and that produces an increased incidence of cancer. So I would say, all things being equal, the gamma rays are probably the most dangerous. I really wouldn't like to be around any of those things. But gamma rays can probably go deeper and cause more things. Depends upon the energy, depends upon the flux density. But they're not good for anything.
The exposure I get from a nuclear power station if I'm living nearby, or if I'm an employee inside that station? Again, is it the gamma rays that are giving me the most amount of biohazard, Roy? Go ahead.
Yes, they are. And if you think about it, the radiometers that you've seen people wear are usually primarily